Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED. Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Guy Marzorati, in this week for Scott Schaefer. And we're excited to have one of California's U.S. senators here with us in studio.
Alex Padilla grew up in the San Fernando Valley neighborhood of Pacoima to two immigrant parents. He was elected to the Los Angeles City Council in 1999 and became LA's youngest city council president, even serving as acting mayor in the aftermath of 9/11.
That's right. Voters in the rest of California might know Padilla for his years in the state Senate and his time as California's top election official during the pandemic and all those changes that came to voting with it.
That's right. Senator Alex Padilla was appointed to his current job in January of 2021 after his predecessor was elected vice president. Kind of a hard act to follow. And he is on the ballot to keep that job this November. Senator Padilla, welcome to The Breakdown.
Thank you both. Thank you both. Good to be back and in person.
It's so lovely to see. Yeah, it's been. Well, we want to kind of dive in. We should tell our listeners we've had you on the show, I think, more than once before, and we've talked a lot about your very compelling biography. So if folks want to listen back to that, get to know you a little better, we'll put that in the show notes. But we did want to talk about all the news that's happening. Gosh, it feels like after 2 years of not a lot happening, there's been a lot going on.
Weren't summers usually quiet? Wasn't that a thing?
Yeah. What happened to quiet summers?
Once upon a time. I don't know. The whole world's been different last few years.
That's
true. Hey, with all the, believe it or not, good news coming out of Congress, we'll absolutely take it.
Yeah, we're going to get to that in a moment. But the reason you're actually in San Francisco today is because of monkeypox. You're going to be doing an event this morning with public health officials and others. And I know that you were one of the first senators to really call for additional vaccines for states. Can you just talk about where you think we are at in this moment? Has the federal government responded appropriately? What are you expecting to hear from folks in California this week?
Yeah, well, what I'm expecting to continue to hear, both in the North and the South, is we need more help. We need more help. I think the Biden-Harris administration has been responsive. There are commitments to send more vaccines to California, most populous state in the nation, and you know, home to a lot of vulnerable populations. But with all the commitments that have been put in place, we need more. We need more vaccines now. We need ongoing commitments to make sure that what is currently an outbreak stays just an outbreak, because we're still getting through the COVID-19 pandemic. So hopefully we would have learned some lessons.
Right. Let's talk about those lessons. I mean, 2.5 years of dealing with COVID, I guess, through the lens of this monkeypox outbreak, what have we learned? Maybe what have we not learned?
Yeah, I think the biggest lesson is making sure that we are acting aggressively early on. And to that, I would say what a difference an administration makes. You know, I think a big part of the challenge, not just for California, but for the country in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic, is that we had a denier sitting in the Oval Office. And so it was frustrating to watch the federal government and a lot of the departments and agencies slow to respond in the earlier days of COVID. Another big difference, look, in the early days of COVID, we didn't know what we were dealing with exactly, and there certainly was not a vaccine. You know, it took almost a year into the true emergency of COVID for vaccines to come out, only emergency use, but use nonetheless. With monkeypox, we have a vaccine that we know works. So that's why so many of my colleagues and I especially have been trying to keep the pressure on the CDC, others, to produce more, distribute more, pay special attention to the vulnerable populations. We know monkeypox, kind of like COVID, is disproportionately impacting communities of color, lower income communities. So let's get the resources and help where we know it's needed the most.
Well, you mentioned the CDC, and you know, we saw the CDC director recently issue a pretty scathing rebuke of the way the agency handled COVID-19. She said it must refocus itself on public health needs, respond faster, and provide information in a way people understand, which sounds sort of obvious. Is that enough? And you mentioned the politics. You know, I do think that the previous administration sort of muddled the message, but the CDC clearly, some of these are sort of systemic issues that the director's recognizing that predate President Trump.
Right. And it's going to maybe sound a little unorthodox, but just follow me here. This is actually an area where my prior experience as California Secretary of State is helpful, not just talking voter registration and getting people out to vote on a nonpartisan basis, but how we communicate to the public, especially coming from California, not just the most populous state in the nation, but the most diverse state in the nation. You have a lot of people, not just voters, whose first language is a language other than English. You have cultural sensitivities, diversity sensitivities to consider if you want to effectively communicate across the board, whether it's, you know, how to participate in elections information, whether it's how to get your kids back safely to school conversations. And when it comes to monkeypox or COVID, certainly accurate truth about diseases, about vaccines, and how to protect yourself and your families. Again, it's something that I think the prior administration wasn't very sensitive to, did not prioritize. We have a new administration, new majorities in Congress, frankly, that do. So let's build on those lessons learned when it comes to effective messaging.
Big news announced yesterday from the White House, President Biden forgiving up to $10,000 in student loan debt, double that for Pell Grant recipients. What was your initial reaction to that announcement?
I was thrilled. I mean, I've been, along with Senator Warren and other colleagues, lobbying for as much relief as we could possibly get. So one of the first questions I get is, should it have been more? Like, we'll continue to press for more, but don't disregard how significant this announcement was. I speak not just as a U.S. senator, but as someone who relied heavily on financial aid, including Pell Grants, when I was applying to college. I mean, I still have a vivid memory of filling out those financial aid forms for the first time, looking at tuition at MIT, a couple of decades ago, compared to my dad's W-2, there was no way I could have afforded college without financial aid. And that included a lot of loans. So whether it's $10,000 for those who qualify in one category, I think the majority of Californians who will qualify for the relief will qualify for the full $20,000 of relief. That is huge, for especially for younger adults, maybe just starting a career, trying to save up to put a down payment on your first home. If you're a young parent, cost of childcare is no joke these days. You know, so $20,000 of relief is hugely significant.
So for, you know, I think some 17 to 20 million people, they're going to have their debt wiped out entirely. For another 20 million, a big portion of it. Those are big numbers. And I think Democrats are hoping that that is not just sort of personal pocketbook relief to folks, but energizing politically. But on the other hand, you have some more centrist Dems and a lot of Republicans who, you know, say this isn't fair. Why should the government be paying for this? How do you make the case politically as, you know, we approach this midterm election to somebody who, you know, might be more skeptical of this plan?
Yeah. I haven't come across too many of them yet, at least not genuine skepticism. There's a lot of cynicism that's out there. But I think the first thing I would share is, look, when people receive this relief on student debt, they're going to be able to reinvest that money into the economy. I mentioned a couple of examples earlier, whether it's a young parent that can better afford maybe childcare, that's going to circulate in your local economy. For people trying to save up to buy their first home, that's recirculating into the economy. So everybody will benefit, even though not everybody is carrying student debt.
If I can just say, isn't that one of the criticisms, right, that this is a economic stimulus at a time when Democrats have really tried to make the case that they are focused on inflation? This seems like pumping potentially a lot more money into the economy.
Well, it's increasing spending power. We're in a very unique time period when it comes to the economy. And there's a lot of head scratching among, quote unquote, experts in Washington on this question of inflation. On the one hand, yes, prices have gone up in certain categories. Again, as a father of three growing boys, I feel it. But at the same time, wages are up. At the same time, unemployment is at record lows. Gas prices have begun to come down. And so we're a little bit of uncharted territory. But the more we can help people balance the checkbook at the end of the month. That's really how we're tackling concerns of inflation. We've done it through the Inflation Reduction Act, prescription drugs, you know, healthcare premium subsidies, energy costs, the climate elements of the Inflation Reduction Act. We have plans to try to restore the child tax credit and subsidize child care. And in this case, helping the millions and millions of people across the country and the millions of people in California, 3.8 million Californians that are carrying student debt. So again, this, the relief is real. It's significant, and it's going to benefit the economy.
Quickly, before we move on to the many other topics we have, I'm just curious, you know, one, I think, pretty valid criticism is just the cost of college and the way that this does nothing to rein that in. Is that an area where there could be sort of a bipartisan approach and legislative solution? Because, as you said, I mean, the numbers we looked at 20, 25 years ago were eye-popping then, and it's way more expensive now.
Right. And so I am aware that whether it's both private and public university systems that are grappling with the same question, why is college so expensive to begin with? You know, there's the vague, what does tuition really cover or not, separate and apart from housing, books, you know, travel, et cetera. I think the COVID-19 pandemic, maybe one of the silver linings, is revisiting really how we structure a higher education experience. And is that a way to bring down costs? There was some experimentation with, you know, online courses and open courseware by a number of universities prior to the pandemic. Early data showed that, look, there's some material that lends itself to maybe remote learning or an online experience, and some that doesn't. And so where are the sweet spots and how can we leverage that to reduce the cost of providing the education and therefore the cost of education and the cost of borrowing to cover an education?
All right, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the newly signed Inflation Reduction Act and drought. California is taking some heat for avoiding federal water cutbacks this month. We'll hear what Senator Padilla thinks about that.
Oh, and the midterms. Democrats face historic headwinds, but a summer of headlines about abortion rights and Trump investigations have liberal voters fired up.
All that and more coming up with Senator Alex Padilla. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code Spotify for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Guy Marzorati, and we have with us in studio today Senator Alex Padilla. He is on the ballot this November against Republican Mark Moyser. And Senator, you know, one of the big issues facing the entire West is drought. We saw some cutbacks from Colorado River to Western states, but not California. We know reservoirs at Lake Mead and Lake Powell, which provide critical water to Southern California, are dangerously low. We've been hearing some chatter from the Arizona senators that California needs to step up and do more. Yeah. What's your take on that? We have senior water rights, which is why California hasn't been asked to make these cutbacks yet. But should we be more proactive?
Yeah. And I appreciate the question. And what's that old saying? Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting over.
Yes, exactly.
A lot of times, Western United States senators kind of do work together, given our collective climate and our interconnectedness when it comes to infrastructure, not just water, but especially water. But there are those differences. You mentioned senior water rights. You know, California was founded and cities began to grow before other population centers. And so those senior water rights have protected us from that perspective. But I do take issue with my colleagues, whether it's Arizona, Nevada, elsewhere, taking shots at California that we should single-handedly bear the brunt of the drought when California has been such a significant leader. I mean, just in the last generation alone, our population has nearly doubled, our economy has grown, and we're maybe 12-15% more water use today than we were a generation ago. We've done a lot in terms of conservation. We've done a lot in terms of efficiency. Clearly much more to do in this new reality because climate change is real. We're hoping to keep productive, constructive conversations and negotiations going for all the states that draw water from the Colorado River.
The agreement that actually governs who draws what from the Colorado River is 100 years old. And clearly it was wildly over-optimistic about how much water was in the river. Add on top of that climate change and just the increasing severity of droughts. Is it time, in your opinion, to maybe redraw that agreement to kind of start from scratch instead of these patchwork fixes that we have to come back to year after year, drought after drought?
Yeah, well, in an informal way, that's kind of what happens periodically. And this is what's happening now when the rainfall or the water levels in the Colorado River are not what we had projected or hoped they would be. Then what are the plans in place to balance it out? You know, who's going to reduce their consumption or their deliveries and by how much? That's where the senior versus junior water rights come into play. We know water is used for a number of different things. California is a great example. A lot goes into our cities and towns for, you know, our use. A lot of it is kept in sort of natural places for environmental restoration or maintenance efforts. A lot goes into agriculture.
A lot
goes into agriculture. But you know what? That's California. It's also Arizona. It's also Nevada. It's also Colorado. It's everywhere. So how do you maintain that balance? We're in a very different climate today than we were 100 years ago, than we were even 20 years ago. So the roadmap for how to deal with wet years versus dry years is kind of outdated. Now, the federal government, because of the authority, will say, well, if you can voluntarily negotiate and come up with a plan that'll get us through the next year, the next 5 years, that's always the best way to do it. We don't need state-to-state feuding or fighting. But if states cannot come to an agreement, then the federal government will exercise its authority, the Bureau of Reclamation to be specific here when it comes to the Colorado River, and will dictate, you know, who gets how much of the pain.
So it doesn't sound like you're ready to tear up that the senior water.
No, I don't think so, because I'm still hopeful that we will reach the agreement and learn from the California experience, learn from the Nevada experience, learn from others' experience, and also look towards the future. You know, the old solutions of, well, let's, you know, make sure that we have water-efficient shower heads and faucets in homes. Well, that helped up until a certain point, but we need more new solutions. I think there's huge promise in water recycling, which was very controversial just a couple of decades ago, but has been demonstrated to work in Orange County and elsewhere in Southern California. Crazy ideas like replacing leaky pipes, probably the single most cost-effective way to conserve water in urban areas. We have a lot of old infrastructure. If we lost less water to leaks, that would be a huge help. And repairing our current infrastructure, including canals.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of excitement in the San Joaquin Valley about covering a lot of the open water canals with solar panels. So we lose less to evaporation while creating some renewable energy.
We can hear the engineer over here.
Right? I'm proud of it.
All right. Well, let's talk. I mean, one big part of this, the Inflation Reduction Act, was drought relief, $4 billion, which Kirsten Sinema, a colleague from Arizona, takes credit for. I guess to start, what's your relationship with her? Yeah, what's her deal? No. But do you guys talk? Like, I feel like in the press, she's kind of an enigma because of her position over the past few years. But you must talk to her. She's a colleague.
Yeah, I do. And not just, unique amongst our colleagues on the Democratic side, but I think the Senate as a whole. I try my best to reach out to all of my colleagues. It's the only way to get business done. You may agree or disagree on a whole heck of a lot with other people, but you're not going to find that common ground unless you're looking for it. And I will say this. I get questions by Democrats in California all the time, whether it's Sinema, whether it's Manchin, whether it's some others. I said, look, if you look at the Democratic side of the aisle, you do have the Sinemas and the Manchins, but you also have the Bernie Sanders, and it's a spectrum, if you will. And the same on the Republican side. It's not all Ted Cruz's and Josh Hawley's. There's the Lisa Murkowski's and the others. And so, you know, it takes effort to get to know your colleagues.
Who's your most unexpected senator friendship?
Unexpected senator friendship. I'll give you the very predictable one. Cory Booker and I sit next together in Judiciary Committee.
Shocking.
So
yeah.
We're commiserating all the time.
Booker,
relatively, for Senate standards, younger men of color, we do have a lot that we've bonded on.
But no Republicans? You're not like best friends with Ted Cruz or anyone like that?
I'll tell you who I've been actually very productive with. The other senator from Texas, John Cornyn. And here's a story that I think people would appreciate. You remember about a year and a half ago when ice storms knocked out the electrical grid in Texas?
Yeah.
You know, I used to chair the Energy Committee in the state Senate. So I know a little bit about our infrastructure and our grid. So I approached them then saying, look, it's only a matter of time before wildfires in California threaten our electrical grid. There's got to be something we can do together here. We crafted a bill, which was then swept into the bipartisan infrastructure law. We asked for $1 billion. The president insisted on $5 billion to work with states, work with utilities to improve not just the reliability of the grid, but the resiliency of the grid. Let's make improvements that modernize the grid that reflects a changing climate. You got a California and a Texan coming together.
You couldn't
together
say climate,
that.
Probably, but...
it was the Power On Act, but the substance was right on, and we'll see the benefits of that for years to come.
Makes sense.
Okay, midterms, the big political narrative nationally right now is that Democrats are having somewhat of a comeback summer. Are you buying that?
Look, I felt good all throughout. You know, so context setting here, I was sworn in January 20th of 2021, hours after the Biden-Harris inauguration. Still in the depths of COVID, in the wake of an insurrection. And as I look back at the last 19 months or so, you know, to think that we passed the American Rescue Plan at a critical time, funding for vaccines, state and local governments, small business assistance, et cetera, the bipartisan infrastructure law late last year, just a couple of months ago, the Safer Communities Act in response to mass shootings in America, a bill that's going to invest significantly in chips and semiconductors, both on the manufacturing side and R&D. More recently, the Inflation Reduction Act, saving costs in healthcare, tackling climate in a historic fashion, and approving a whole bunch of federal judges along the way. I think the whole last year and a half has been tremendously productive. So a lot to talk about. Democrats have a story to tell as we're 70-some-odd days from the election.
How much of it should be that positive message, this is what you're voting for, versus the other side, which is Democrats have a lot to sort of prop up to vote against, right? The abortion decision at the Supreme Court, the questions over democracy and whether the former president and his allies are trying to undermine our entire system. I mean, how do you balance that? And when you talk to voters, are they more energized by the positive or the negative?
Yeah. Look, I don't think it's an either or. I think you've got to lay out both. And that's ultimately what elections are about. It's a choice. So if you're on the November ballot, how do you compare and contrast with your opponent and draw the distinction for voters to decide who they prefer? You know, my side of the aisle, I just ran through a litany of what we stand for. Republicans were to reclaim majority in Congress, I believe the Dobbs decision by the Supreme Court is just the beginning. And if you care about voting rights, you know where Republicans stand. If you care about choice, you know where Republicans stand. If you care about addressing climate, you know where Republicans stand. They're still in denial. If you care about immigration reform, long overdue in the United States, and no state has more at stake in it than California, you clearly know where Republicans stand, on and on and on. And to think that whether it's Trump or Trumpism is still so influential on the Republican side of the aisle, it is very, very dangerous. We saw what happened January 6th last year. We now have election deniers, not just, you know, on social media, but running for office, running for secretaries of state and county elections officials in other parts of the country. If they're successful, we're going to be in for a constitutional crisis in 2024. It's up to voters to decide if that's what we want or not.
You heard Governor Gavin Newsom a few months ago say, "Where the hell is my party?" He was talking about the Dobbs decision, but also I think a lot of these rollbacks of civil rights that we're seeing in red states. What did you make of that? I mean, did the party need a wake-up call?
Yeah. I share the frustration sometimes. You know, I rattled off if Republicans were to take over, we're not going to just not make progress on some of these issues, immigration reform, choice, equality, climate, et cetera. But we will go backwards. When Mitch McConnell says, yes, a national abortion ban is on the agenda if they reclaim the majority, that is very real. So it should rattle us. I think it's not just registering more voters, getting folks to the ballot box, but in the Senate, I've been outspoken since day one. Let's eliminate the filibuster. The filibuster is the only reason we haven't made progress on all those issues. So if we elect a few more Democrats that are willing to get rid of the filibuster, at least make some exemptions for these critical issues, we'll continue to make progress that we've just begun.
Well, just on that issue, what could Democrats promise voters around abortion rights if Democrats maintain control of Senate, potentially
get
the House?
Senators,
is it just don't let Republicans take over and roll back these rights? I mean, given what you lay out about the filibuster, what can voters actually expect?
Look, when it comes to choice, it's very simple. Codify Roe v. Wade into federal law. It is that simple. I do think there's more than 50 votes to get that done today, but there's not the 60 votes to overcome the filibuster obstacle to allow for the 51 votes to get it done today. Same thing can be said on securing our fundamental right to vote. Proud of the work that we did when I was Secretary of State to make it easier to register, stay registered, cast your ballot in California. What a contrast to what we see in Florida, in Georgia, in Texas, you know, so many other states. It's so pivotal. I mean, Roe v. Wade stood for 50 years. So did the Federal Voting Rights Act before the Supreme Court gutted it in 2013. So restoring confidence in the Supreme Court, restoring confidence in Congress, our democratic institutions are under attack because of the big lie. Again, back to the Trumpism effect. We can turn the corner. I think that's all at stake this election.
All right. Just a couple minutes left. We like to end on a more fun or personal note. So we talked before we went on air. Your kids are now 7, 9, and 14. You have one of the longest commutes. I guess Alaska might be a little further. How has it been like being, because you're one of the youngest senators, as we talked about, and one of the few with young children. What's that balance like?
Not going to lie, it's been hard. It's been a challenge. The job in and of itself is a lot. I take my family responsibility seriously. You know, it's funny when negotiations are moving slow and there's a threat of we're going to have to work through the weekend. You know, I'm the first one that starts running around both sides of the aisle saying, I don't know about you, but I love my wife and kids and I want to get home. Let's get this done. And on top of that, you know, immediately in a campaign cycle as well. When I'm in Washington, I miss my family dearly. We're no strangers to FaceTime and Zoom and all that to try to stay connected. And the time difference, that's something I didn't expect. You know, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I want to do is call my wife, Angela, and say hello. But a 4 o'clock in the morning call,
I wouldn't
be very well received.
So what happened?
Whether it's the good morning or the good night call, we're figuring it out. We're trying to find our rhythm.
Awesome. Well, Senator Alex Padilla, thank you so much for your time, for joining us. We should say you're on the ballot this November against Republican Mark Moisier twice. There's the race to fill out the rest of your appointed term and then a full 6-year term. But thanks so much for spending some time with us this morning.
Good to be back.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Political Breakdown. We are a production of KQED Public Radio. Guy's our producer, and our engineer today is Christopher Beal.
For more politics coverage from KQED, subscribe to our Political Breakdown newsletter at kqed.org/newsletters/politicalbreakdown. This morning, Marisa, we have a preview of the end of the legislative session, bills we're watching on the fast food industry, on Governor Newsom's controversial Care Corps plan. Just about a week left to get all that done. And then that veto of injection sites that you covered.
That's right. Newsom's getting a lot of heat from supporters of that and a big sigh of relief from some of his own political backers who would like to see him on the ballot in 2024. So check that out and sign up for more.
All right, everyone. You can find me on Twitter at Guy Marzorati.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. You can follow me on Twitter at M Lagos. Have a good one. We'll be right back.
Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.